ESPN College Football Podcast.
Welcome one, welcome all to the ESPN College Football Podcast for Thursday, August 11th, 2022. We are getting ever so close to the start of the college football season later this month, week zero, and then a full slate of games beginning in September. I'm Adam Rittenberg, joined by my friend and colleague, David Hale, who I saw last week, along with Taylor and others in Bristol. It was so wonderful to actually be in your presence, Hale. How are we doing today as we're days away from actual games?
Yeah, exciting to have anyone be graced by my presence. It's a rare accomplishment. We're knee deep in it now. I feel like, you know, there's camp updates coming from all over. The downside to this, this time of year always kind of, it's bittersweet because I get excited about the season, but this is also like the week when you start hearing about the guys who got hurt in camp and they're out for the season or they're out for 6 weeks or something like that. I'm always a little bummed to remember that it isn't all good news in August.
No, and we kind of want good news after a summer of interesting news, but not always fun news to report. We'll get into a key injury that you did some reporting on earlier this week, unfortunately, involving one of the ACC's top quarterback. But I got to ask right off the top, Hale, were you somehow the person who got into the coaching poll voting and put Texas at number one? Because I have my suspicions. Maybe our guy, Dave Wilson, it's got to be somebody on our staff who was able to rig that. So, you know, just confess right now and get it out in the open.
I believe Dave Duffy is the guy that we have to blame for that, our resident editor in Texas aficionado. No, not me, but to quote from the great When Harry Met Sally movie, I'll have whatever who voted for Texas number one is having, because they're on the good stuff, whatever it is.
Yeah. I think Jake Spavadal, who from Texas State, you know, kind of indicated that he might have been the one, you know, with their
Spav,
proximity.
So that's fine. It's good.
Yeah,
it's good.
Yeah. But who knows? I think it's a fun mystery to have.
I like it. You build them up to knock them back down again. That's the way we do things in the media.
It's the Lou Holtz approach, right? Against the University of the Navy or whatever he called Navy back way back when. So, fun times with the coaches poll. We'll get into that a little bit, but let's start at what you referenced there, Dave, key injury. And obviously Wake Forest is dealing with at least the immediate loss of quarterback Sam Hartman. You know, he suffered what's been termed as a non-football related, he has an injury or situation. I don't even know how to characterize it, but it happened earlier this week, and Wake Forest, unfortunately, will be without one of the ACC's top passers and a guy who helped them to an Atlantic Division title and an ACC championship game berth and has been a multi-year starter. What do you know about that situation from talking to folks in and around that program, and how is it going to impact Wake Forest here as they get ready for their season?
So a couple of things. Number one, they have been cagey about information, and that is required by HIPAA and privacy laws. They could get around that if Sam had said, yeah, just go ahead and tell anybody. But I know Sam a little bit. He's a very private person. He's a very competitive person. And my understanding is a lot of the privacy here is coming from Sam himself. He does not want this out there in the short term. What I have been told is, absolutely a physical issue. It is not a mental health issue, or I mean, people have speculated about all kinds of other things. This is a physical issue that came to light on Tuesday. There were some serious concerns at Wake Forest about his physical health at that time. What I was told by multiple folks around Wake Forest is that literally everybody from the strength staff to the medical staff and coaches did exactly what they were supposed to do. He underwent a procedure on Tuesday evening. By Wednesday morning, he was back out at practice, addressed the team in good spirits. How soon he can get back to actually playing is a thing nobody really wanted to speculate about. The only thing Dave Clawson told me definitively is he will play football again. This is not the end of Sam Hartman as a football player. But I think they're also being very careful. And one of the things you kind of have to remember about Sam is he's sort of a fringy NFL prospect right now. Like, he's very good, super competitive, smart dude, but he's undersized. I mean, he is 5'10 and a half, 5'11, good arm, but not probably NFL superstar arm. And so, you know, I asked him in July when he was at ACC kickoff, I was like, what kind of feedback did you get from NFL draft expert folks, and he said they told me I was 5'11". You know, so like that's the knock on him. But he's sort of fringy, and I think there's a lot of folks who would say, like, look, he's worth spending a late draft pick on or having on a roster because he adds value as a smart competitive player. And then if you have an injury or something like this that comes up, I think that you risk hurting his draft value, and that's a big thing that they don't want to do right now. Don't put timelines or expectations on his return, because if he doesn't quite meet them, we don't want it to be held against him later. And I think, you know, again, I'm sort of reading between the lines on some of what may be the root cause of this. But I think if it's sort of what some of the things that people have speculated about, it might be a thing where there's just, until they can go and do some follow-up tests in a few weeks, there's really no timetable to be put on it until they have more information. But what we can say is right now, he's healthy, he's fine, he's not in any immediate danger. He's been around the team. He expects to play again. Whether that's play again in a month, play again this season, play again eventually, I think we're still a little too early to be able to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly good news that his overall health is projecting well, because when you hear that, you think the worst. You think some type of disease or some type of real emergency situation. And while it sounds like they had some of that on Tuesday night, they were sort of able to get past it in a relatively quick fashion. You know, just looking forward for this team, given its outlook, you know, who steps in? How does that offense look from here? Because I did a pretty deep dive for ESPN Plus on quarterback intel from coaches. And one thing that a number of coaches said about Hartman is that, you know, he is a really intelligent player. He's got his good arm. He can get it all done. But that offense, which, you know, is very distinct and is hard to defend. And they do some things at the line of scrimmage that you don't see from a lot of other teams with their delayed mesh RPO type thing. You know, so can someone else step in and have anywhere near the type of success as Hartman, or do they have to really reconsider what they do and really their outlook for that unit going forward? Because Wake Forest's success under Dave Clawson has largely been because of this offense.
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing that Dave Clawson did say yesterday is Mitch Griffiths is essentially number one on the depth chart right now. He was probably their number three QB last year behind Michael Kern. Also, Kern will be in the mix. How much or who kind of wins that job? I think the fact that Griffiths is the guy right now probably speaks to where they kind of think Kern is. But these are both of them are guys who have been in the system for a few years now. They know the system. But as you point out, that delayed mesh RPO puts so much stress on the quarterback to both be calm in a chaotic situation as, you know, your defenders are kind of collapsing on you and you haven't quite let go of the football yet or decided what you're doing with it, and B, to make really good decisions about when you're going to pull it, when you're going to throw it downfield, when you're going to have the handoff. Sam Hartman's just excellent at that. Like, it's his bread and butter. He does it better than anyone. And so I don't think anybody can step in and repeat it. And, you know, two of the other things that are sort of important here, their left tackle, Zach Tom, who became I think he was drafted in the second or third round this year. I mean, really good player, is gone. And they lost their leading rusher, Christian Beal-Smith, from last year as well. So it's going to be a much different looking offense for Wake, even if Sam Hartman was healthy. I think that they can certainly survive the first 3 weeks. Those games are winnable. They got Clemson, their fourth game of the season. And I think there's a fair question about, especially given last year's result, whether they were going to be able to beat Clemson with or without Sam Hartman. The game that really matters, I mean, certainly the Clemson game matters, but the week after that is at Florida State. And to me, that's a swing game in Wake Forest season. They have high expectations after winning 11 last year. They have a bunch of returning talent on both sides of the ball. They want to win big again. And I don't know that winning big has to be predicated on did you beat Clemson, particularly if Hartman's not there. But that Florida State game the next week, I think in a lot of ways is going to define whether we're talking about a team that can go 6-6 or another team that can win 10 games.
Yeah, and there's so many of those games that are sort of the next level below maybe the premier ones that are going to shape these league races. And we're going to get into that a little bit later on the pod. You know, divisions that seem to be quite wide open, and certainly both ACC divisions, you kind of qualified last year and may qualify again this year. You could certainly build a case for a number of teams in that conference. Did want to get to the biggest news story of the week before the Hartman injury came to light, and that was the Big Ten media rights deal, which hasn't officially been announced and may not be announced for at least a week. I would imagine it won't go too much further into August, but the basic parameters have been reported here on ESPN and other outlets, and it's essentially this. Fox will remain the lead partner for the Big Ten, which we knew was going to be the case the whole time. They're invested with the Big Ten Network, and you'll have Big Noon Kickoff and so forth. But the other two main partners going forward, at least on the linear television side, are CBS and NBC, and not ESPN. CBS is expected to get that mid-afternoon window for a Big Ten game. They're filling the spot that has been occupied by the SEC, which will no longer be occupied by the SEC beginning in 2024. And then Notre Dame, which we've just associated, NBC, which we've been associated with Notre Dame, as its exclusive football show, essentially, for Notre Dame Saturdays, home games in South Bend. Now they are a bigger player in the market because they're going to have Big Ten games on in the nighttime, in the primetime window. So it's going to go from Fox to CBS to NBC in most weeks. ESPN, our employer, which has been broadcasting Big Ten football games since 1982, 1983, is no longer a partner. And this was sort of the next major event we were waiting for in college athletics, the announcement of the Big Ten television rights deal, media rights deal, and how that was going to impact future realignment, how it was going to impact the Pac-12, the Big 12, really every other league. So what was your reaction, Hale, as you learned about this, and how do you think it'll impact the Big Ten, but also everybody else that's affected by such a major media rights agreement, which is set to net the Big Ten well over $1 billion a year?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack from this. And I start by saying I'm almost wary to go too into the weeds on this because I wonder how much fans even care, what network is broadcasting what. But the fact of the matter is we talk about the future and the evolution of college football, which has dominated the conversation all offseason. This is a key point in that. This is a key domino to fall. I'll be very interested to see what the final numbers look like because, they were talking about 100 million distribution per team with a 16-team league. And I talked to a lot of ADs and TV folks who said, boy, I don't know, that sounds really high to me. And if they actually end up getting close to that, I mean, it moves the needle to the point where the SEC probably, which thought they were in a catbird seat just like a couple months ago, has to look at it and say, well, wait, are we being undervalued now? And certainly if you look at a league like the ACC, who's locked into a TV contract in 2036, they don't know what the heck's going on. Pac-12 and the Big 12 are still trying to figure out what their role is at all. The Big Ten is very fortunate in that these media rights packages came up at a time where there are more bidders. I mean, if you're looking at simply supply and demand, the supply is the same and maybe getting smaller to some extent of what really moves the needle. And the demand is up big time because CBS needed a replacement for their midday 3:30 SEC game. NBC wants to expand its foothold. And then you have sort of the streaming wars and which one of those Netflix or Amazon or Apple decide that they want to dip their toe into the college football waters. Those are certainly parts of the conversation. So I'm fascinated by what the numbers are going to be because they're going to set a market. I'm fascinated by what the NBC relationship with the Big Ten is going to be because certainly we've had a lot of conversations about what is Notre Dame's future as an independent and is the Big Ten the ideal home for them? And if there's already some TV relationship between the Big Ten and NBC and Notre Dame and NBC, maybe there's a way to make all of that work. I just think there's so many dominoes that potentially fall. And then the last of them is, we've been wondering what comes next after adding UCLA and USC, and do they have travel partners in the Big Ten, and does it matter, and will the Big Ten try to expand its reach in the Pac-12? I think you have a lot of the stasis in terms of continued realignment with the Pac-12 is kind of just waiting to see what happens with this Big Ten deal. And so is Oregon going to move? Is Washington going to move? Is Stanford, Cal? All of these questions are predicated on what comes next with the Big Ten. So to me, the biggest thing in this is that not just what's going to happen and what the final numbers look like, but that we scratch that one off the list of things that has to happen before more and more things start happening.
Yeah, you're right. There's so much here. And I wanted to call attention to something that Kevin Warren, the Big Ten commissioner, told me back in July when I was with him at League Media Days. And I think it's going to be prophetic in him saying, you know, this is not just a normal one unit television deal. I want people 20 years from now to look back and go, wow, man, they were ahead of the curve on that deal. And I think they are in a number of ways. I think the length of the contract, which again, isn't necessarily new, because Jim Delaney did something similar 6 years ago. It's why the Big Ten's back in the market so soon ahead of some of these other leagues. I think the era of the long-term one-partner media deal is likely over, at least in the immediate future. You're going to have more contracts that are 6 years, 7 years, maybe 8 years, but that's even on the long end. And you're going to have them spread out to multiple partners. And you bring up the streaming issue, and I want to get into that in a minute, because I think that's also part of why you do a short-term contract, because you don't know how the behavior of the consumer is going to change in 5 years. There were initial conversations with Amazon and Apple. I was told they went really well, but they're not going to be a big part of this deal. They could be a major part of a deal a year from now, 2 years from now, 6 years from now. The next Big Ten deal could be very heavily tied to those streaming services, who, by the way, we both know have way more money than everybody else. And so the money is not the issue. It's more the delivery of the product and how the fan behavior changes. I mean, I watch games on my tablet, but I also watch a lot of games on an old satellite. So I'm in my 40s. I'm old. I get it. I'm out of that demographic. But I think it's really important for fans to understand why these deals are going to be structured this way, both in terms of who's involved and how long they are, because I think that's really important. You mentioned Notre Dame, Hale, and that was certainly a part of this, especially because NBC is now going to be tied to the Big Ten. And you know, for a long, long time, all they were tied to in college football essentially were those Notre Dame home games. Jack Swarbrick, the Notre Dame athletic director, spoke about this. I think it was in a campus-wide chat earlier this week, and he praised the Big Ten. He said he called it a brilliant strategy by Kevin Warren, said it played out marvelously for him. But regarding Notre Dame, he said this: it's also perfect for Notre Dame. We need NBC to have more college football to more effectively promote our games and to talk about our games and to have NBC seen in that light. So that, meaning the Big Ten adding NBC as a partner, was great for us that they got a big piece of this. How much do you take Jack Swarbrick at his word? Because I think, you know, Notre Dame certainly could really believe this, that this is great for NBC and for them and for their product. But they're also going to be dealing with the fact that everything that they say does no longer go, because you're going to have a network that's also trying to promote and manage its Big Ten content in addition to its Notre Dame home football content.
Yeah, I mean, I think the gist of what he's saying should be taken at face value to some extent. I mean, this is one of the things when we talk about, ESPN versus other networks, and I don't mean to be sort of a homer here at all, but like, ESPN talks about college football all day long, every day. They have all of these outlets to talk college football, whether it's SportsCenter, whether it's ESPN.com, whether it's podcasts like this. But there's this huge infrastructure built around college football that it really does become a thing where you can help brand build, you can help set the narrative. NBC's never been that. They're just Notre Dame. And so I think he's right in saying that the more you expand your college football footprint for a network, the more you start to help dictate the narrative and the talking points, the more you help to start dictate what does the playoff look like and which teams are good and how are we going to, you know, who gets higher priority and what's being watched. Are you watching a Notre Dame game as maybe not a Notre Dame fan, but you're watching it because it's on NBC and you're going to watch the game that comes on after that too? I think all of these things sort of play a role and are true. But at the end of the day, what we're really talking about is Notre Dame going to maintain independence? Is Notre Dame going to look at the money that is being paid out to the Big Ten and say, well, you know, we need a part of that money too? Is Notre Dame going to look at how the future of college football is changing and say, well, we need to make sure we're on the inside and not the outside of these conversations, which I think they will be no matter what happens. But the fact of the matter is, and I've said this really over the last 2 years, as much as we're talking about the changing face of college football and realignment and all of those things, all of that is happening in conjunction, as you mentioned, with a vastly changing and constantly changing media world, where consumption habits are changing, ownership in media is changing, all of these things are changing at the same time. They go hand in hand. And so to me, I think it's hard to sort of say what this deal means, because we'd all just be guessing at the end of the day for Notre Dame. But Jack Swarbrick is real media savvy. He gets this stuff probably as good as anybody does. And so if he's sitting up there patting Kevin Warren on the back, that tells me – it doesn't tell me that they're about ready to join the Big Ten. But it does tell me that he's certainly not going to rule that out.
No, and again, I think I really believe – and I think you do too, even though I know you cover the ACC pretty closely, that there's really two choices for Notre Dame. There's remaining independent, which I will always default to because it's what they want. And if they can, in a perfect world, they remain independent forever. The second choice is joining the Big Ten. I think that those are your real two options unless something changes dramatically in the landscape. I know the ACC would love to have Notre Dame. I'm sure the SEC would and the Big 12 and the Pac 12. But I think those are your options if you're Notre Dame. And now you at least know the basic parameters of this deal. You're going to learn the money soon. Jack Swarbrick probably already knows how much money Big Ten schools are going to get paid out from this this essentially three-partner media rights deal that the Big Ten is soon to announce. But I wanted to get back to the streaming services because I was told by a source who was fairly knowledgeable, I shouldn't even say very knowledgeable about the talks with those platforms, and said that the Big Ten was very impressed. I mean, the Big Ten was impressed with their ideas, was impressed with their approach. I think there's probably still a little bit of hesitancy because they're such new players in this market. They're broadcasting NFL Thursday Night Football. They're broadcasting the MLB or streaming, I should say, on Friday nights on Apple TV. But again, are you getting everything that you would get from an ESPN or some of these other traditional networks? I do wonder how it impacts the Pac-12's negotiations. I think it's something that George Kliavkov could really look into, especially if there's a desire from one of those streaming services to be a heavy player in the Pac-12 content space. But I also think you're looking in the near future, Big 12, next Big 10 negotiate. I mean, I think anything that comes up in the next 3 or 4 years, these services, these companies, which if they do want to get involved in live rights for college football, are going to be bigger and bigger players and more interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot to unpack with that because I think to your point, the biggest obstacle right now is just consumer habits. And I'm old enough to remember it wasn't that long ago. Remember when Netflix decided they were going to split apart their mailing you DVD business from their downloading a movie on your and everybody was like lost their mind. What? I can't have to pay separately for my mail DVDs. And now the whole idea of that just seems lunacy because consumer habits changed that quickly. So I think that this can change quickly. I've talked to a lot of different folks from TV programming to conference commissioners and ADs about this. And it's like, well, what matters right now? Because you remember the last time that we had realignment in the early 2010s, it was all about cable distribution. It was not even about, it was getting into markets that had households. It didn't even matter if those households cared about college football or not, because when you have your basic cable package and the Big Ten network comes with that, or the ACC or SEC network comes with that, you're paying for it. That has changed, and it's going to change a whole lot more. But it's not, we're in a gray area here right now. It's not all the way there. We're in this middle ground. We are at the Netflix trying to explain why instant downloads are better than getting a DVD mailed to you. Most people still consume linear TV, particularly for sports. So when we're talking, and this is the brilliance of doing a shorter term deal, is because right now your money is going to come still from the traditional avenues. But the future, the writing is on the wall, and it will change. And you're right, the infrastructure isn't necessarily there for streaming to provide the same caliber of content or broadcast that an ESPN game does. But there might be a future where you're watching a game with VR goggles on, and you have stats that are popping up on screen the whole time, and it can feel like you're actually just sitting on the field behind the quarterback as he's throwing a pass. Like, I don't know what all this is. Again, I'm in my 40s and old too. But, like, the future is there, and it's not that far off now. And I think everybody sees that what media rights are today is not what it was 10 years ago. And 10 years from now, it's probably going to look a whole heck of a lot different too.
Last thing on this, what do you think is the next media or next big event related to this, whether it's the Pac-12 finalizing a deal that keeps everybody happy-ish, or are we going to see a maybe more realignment? You know, the Big 12 and the Pac-12 seem to still be at each other's throats, at least if you read Twitter. So what's sort of the next big thing coming up? Because this was the first one. Now it's essentially happened. We know Notre Dame's position, at least initially, from Jack Swarbrick. So what's next to come?
I think there's probably three big dominoes coming up. I think one is the Pac-12's deal, because this will start to tell us what these leagues who have been poached, what their value is and what the value of the biggest brands are compared to everybody else. And one, that means a lot for the Pac-12 and the Big 12, just in terms of determining their own worth and can you keep teams happy. But two, I wonder how much, if it shows up that, like, boy, losing USC or losing Texas cost us 40% of our media deal, or so I'm just throwing numbers out there. How many of those other teams that really are the big elephants in the room start to say, well, wait a minute, if our value is this, why are we splitting this evenly with the Vanderbilts and Illinois of the world? I think those are conversations that are going to have to come up at some point as we see how much the behemoths really drive this. Two is the college football playoff. And what is that going to look like? And I think we're getting a lot closer to finding some real answers on that. But that is going to drive a lot of decisions on who can be where, what can be tolerated, how much money you need to sort of ante up and play the game. And then the third is, I think, particularly as it relates to the ACC, who's going to go to court? Who's going to pay lawyers a whole hell of a lot of money to challenge a grant of rights to say, it's time for us to get out of this and go somewhere where we can make more money and be a bigger player? And I think, you know, again, a lot of people were kind of waiting to see how this Big 12 or the Big 10 deal shook out, just to say, like, all right, now we have the numbers. Now we know what it's essentially costing us by not being in the Big 10. What's it going to cost us to get there? And you can make that decision a lot simpler. And every year that passes, the cost of that getting out of that grant of rights goes down, and the cost of staying where you are and losing that Big Ten revenue goes up. So I would argue that's probably the biggest. If we're asking what's the future of college football realignment, that's going to be the biggest domino to fall when somebody decides, all right, we figured some sort of case out. We're going to send the lawyers to court and see what we can make happen.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, certainly the next few months, as those reactions start to happen. And certainly George Kliavkoff, the Pac-12 commissioner, hard at work to try to keep his league happy and united. And it sounds like they are, at least from what some of the reports out west are saying. Before we move on, there are a couple things going on at ESPN that we want to mention. First, ESPN, in partnership with Peyton Manning's Omaha Productions, present Always College Football with ESPN college football analyst Greg McElroy. With off-seasons being a thing of the past, Greg McElroy goes year-round with analysis, opinions, and insight on top teams and under-the-radar stories from coast to coast. That's Always College Football. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And he was the face of the New York Yankees and the most admired player in baseball. The Captain tells the story of Derek Jeter's life and Hall of Fame career. Catch the final episode on Thursday, August 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN, and every episode streaming on ESPN+. I do want to talk a little bit of football on the podcast and with the season coming up. You know, I've made it clear on this pod, on any radio show that I'm on, that I'm not a fan of divisions. I don't know if you are either, Hale. I know your colleague and our friend Andrew Adelson and I have written about this. We wrote about this back in 2015, the idea of whether divisions should be eliminated. But and they are going to be eliminated, at least in most of the major conferences. But they are still around this year, which leads us to a fun topic here. You're kind of looking at what might be up for grabs. Whether we could do a division, we could do an entire league, because I think the Big 12 might qualify as a whole league in this conversation. But you know, there's the Big 10 East and the SEC West, and but there's also some divisions that are really wide open. Even the Hartman news might change a little bit of what could happen in the ACC Atlantic. And so as you look at the landscape, which is still divisions for the most part this year, although a lot of them are going away very, very soon, what sort of fits into that category of something where so many possibilities are still at least, you know, you could argue for them at the, at this stage of the year, may not hold up in about a month or 6 weeks from now, but we can still say this could happen or this could happen. This team could win or this team could win.
Well, I think you're bringing up the Big 12 as a very valuable one, because I can't remember the last time, I mean, for a conference that has essentially been owned by Oklahoma for the better part of the last decade, and really Texas and Oklahoma only for the better part of the last, I don't know, however far back you can go. I'm looking at the FPI projections here. Kansas is the only team that they give a 0% chance of winning the Big 12 to. So there's nine teams that at least are in the dumb and dumber, so you're telling me there's a chance model. And honestly, if you told me, hey, Joe McGuire totally turns around Texas Tech, they win the Big 12 this year, I'd say it's unlikely, but I wouldn't say that's a crazy thing to have happen. What is Oklahoma under Brent Venables? I think there's serious questions there, but they could also go 12-0. Wouldn't shock me either. Texas has a 40% odds, according to FPI, and they're the favorite. Maybe FPI is the one who voted Texas number one, yes, in the coaches' poll.
Just thinking that.
I don't exactly buy that, but I mean, look, there is a bunch of teams that have a shot there, and that is wide open. I think it's fascinating. But I'll tell you the other one that I think is more fascinating than it's given credit for because of who the defending champ is. But the SEC East is interesting to me because Georgia was great last year, but lost so much off of that team. And they've recruited great, so they're probably still going to be great. But is Georgia national championship Georgia, or are they falling back a little bit? Well, look, Kentucky's been recruiting way better than Kentucky ever had before, and they're a really good team, and they've got a really good quarterback in Will Levis, and they've got a really good defense. And then you look at Florida. Well, how quickly can Billy Napier turn things around? Surely things at Florida aren't as bad as they appeared at the end of last year. So is it a quick fix at Florida? Is it a longer-term thing? And then the other team that I think is so fascinating is Tennessee, because the more and more that I dug in on Tennessee and the numbers and the way that season unfurled last year, they got better as the year went along. Hendon Hooker was really good. Everything Josh Heupel did just seemed to fit perfectly with what Tennessee wanted to do. Like, I was shocked at how good that team ended up being by the end of the year. And if you look at some of the underlying numbers, you know, talk to like our friend Bill Connolly about sort of the math behind some of this stuff, it's not hard to make a case to say Tennessee is a much better football team than people are giving them credit for right now. So look, of course, Georgia should be the prohibitive favorite in the SEC East going into the season. But I think there's more talent in the rest of that division than people give them credit for. And so it's, the fallback from Georgia doesn't have to be big for somebody else to jump up and give them a real run for their money.
I love that we're talking about this because I agree with much of what you're saying. I would refer back to FPI, and they have Georgia as a bigger favorite than Alabama to win its division at nearly 90%. And then it drops all the way down to 5.9% for Kentucky. And then Florida's all the way at 2.4, Tennessee's in the one. So clearly FPI does not agree, but here's why I think it's interesting. All three of those teams have quarterbacks who can make a difference. And, I think you look at Kentucky and they've been a team under Mark Stoops that has, you know, kind of defied so many expectations here the last few years, but they've done it with defense. They've done it with line of scrimmage play. They've done it with the run game. Now, can they do it with a quarterback in Will Levis, who's on the NFL draft radar? He's a guy who is projected by some as a number one pick in next year's draft. So could he be the reason why they take the next step? They're going to have to do it that way. If they want to challenge Georgia, even a reworked Georgia defense, Stetson Bennett's back, and they have a lot of things that are exciting there. But if they're going to take down Georgia, they're going to need their quarterback to do it. Florida, I think it hasn't been a great offseason for them in a number of ways, but they also have a guy in Anthony Richardson. If things come together and he takes that next step under Billy Napier, he can be dangerous. Physically, he can do it all. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see how he performs in that opener against Utah, which is typically one of the better defenses in the country. So, and then you mentioned Hooker, and you just look at what Josh Heupel did. It was really the kind of the blueprint for a first year coach. Obviously, it's great to win, but the other way to curry favor among your new fan base as a first year coach is to be exciting on offense, and that's what Tennessee was. I think they had their first 1,000 yard receivers since 2012. Hooker was outstanding. They were fun to watch, and as you mentioned, they improved as the season went along. It's just can any of those teams take down Georgia? And you know, again, I would look at Kentucky if Levis does improve and becomes, you know, really one of the better quarterbacks in the country. That could be a really interesting race.
It's so fascinating that you mentioned those three quarterbacks, because they all have sort of first round draft pick conversations around them, and they are all very good. And I swore to myself I was not going to spend any time this season talking about Stetson Bennett not being an elite quarterback. We're not even halfway into August, and I already feel the pull. I feel this gravitational pull forcing me to say Georgia actually doesn't even have close to the best quarterback in that division, and that could be the difference. I'm not going to do it. Not saying it. Stetson Bennett for the Heisman. Go Stetson.
You see that picture of Stetson Bennett on check-in day when it said, like, how many years have you been here? And he had, like, 87. That was pretty good. I like that he can laugh at himself. He knows what he is. And
who's living a better life than Stetson Bennett right now?
Seriously. Like, how many of us would just trade everything that we've had in our lives to be Stetson Bennett for the last 6 months? It's been pretty fun to watch. The one I have to ask you about, Hale, is the ACC, because I feel like this topic, which was brilliantly presented to us by producer Taylor, is almost inspired by the ACC, especially the ACC Coastal, because that's a division where there's seemingly a new champion every year. Last year we got Pitt, and they obviously went on to win the entire conference. But as you look at the ACC outlook, really in both divisions, because Clemson, even though they're a heavy FPI favorite to not only win the division 75%, but the conference 59%, you know, with their questions at quarterback, and is DJ Uiagalelei going to be the guy that we saw in snippets in 2020, or is he going to be the guy that we saw struggle for pretty much the entire 2021 season? If he's not better, I think they're vulnerable. And then the Coastal, I mean, shoot, Carolina is actually the favorite, FPI favorite, edging out Pitt in the Coastal. But you can make a case for a number of teams on that side. One Atlantic Division team that I really want to hear your thoughts about, because I've gotten incredible reviews from coaches on their quarterback, is Louisville. You know, and several ACC coaches told me, if you poll coaches in this league, and you probably know this already, who do you not want to face? A lot of them would say Malik Cunningham, just because of the dual threat ability, and obviously was much better at limiting mistakes last year than he was in 2020. So, you know, are both of these divisions in the up for grabs category, or one of them, neither? How do you look at it?
Yeah, it's funny. I did ACC radio earlier today, and they were asking who my sleeper pick in the ACC was. And I was like, how do you pick a sleeper out of an entire league that almost everyone could probably go 9-3 and almost anyone could probably go 4-8? Like, there are a lot of wide berths within this league. I think, you know, obviously Clemson has probably is the safest bet because they're so talented on defense. And you're right. Look, DJ Uiagalelei was a problem last year, but he wasn't the only problem on offense. The offensive line really struggled at times, and I think it's fair to ask how much they've improved. Dabo said in the spring, we need to get in the portal and get another offensive lineman. The only time he has ever said anything positive about the transfer portal. And you know what they did? Nothing. They didn't go get an offensive lineman. Their wide receiving core was decimated last year, and hopefully they're healthier this year, but I don't know that it's good. I don't know that it's a good – nobody in that group, aside from maybe 5 or 6 games out of Joe Ngata's career, has been really good. So it's not just about DJ. There's a lot of things that have to go right on that offense in order for them to take a genuine step forward offensively, and they're doing it with effectively an entirely new assistant coaching staff. So there's questions at Clemson. NC State, everybody thinks they're going to be really good, except we all know NC State's history, and when we think that, they don't live up to it. You mentioned Louisville, and to me, they're one of the most fascinating teams in the ACC because they have been plagued by bad luck, blown leads, just, you know, putting the Clemson game last year, they should have won easy. They were going down the score, and Malik Cunningham gets hurt, misses the next 3 series, and that was the difference in the game. I would agree Cunningham is good. I hesitate to say he's sort of the poor man's Lamar Jackson because he's better than that. He's like an upper middle class man's Lamar Jackson. And it's insane that a team like Louisville has gotten both of them over this like 8 years time span. but he's really impossible to defend, but he needs some help, and they didn't really give him much, particularly on the defensive side of the ball last year. I'll be fascinated to see how much they can improve. What does Wake do? When does Sam Hartman come back? Because they're legitimate players in this. How much has Florida State improved? And I mean, even when you look at the bottom of the Atlantic, theoretically, Boston College still has Phil Dracovic, who is a really good player, and Zay Flowers, who is a really good player, and a 1,000-yard back last year, Pat Garwell. And Syracuse brings in Robert and I and that offensive staff from Virginia that just put up a ton of points last year. They give the ball to Garrett Schrader from the beginning of the year, and boy, his skill set looks a whole lot like Taysom Hill, who Robert and I had at BYU not that long ago. And they've got maybe the best running back in the country in Sean Tucker. There ain't an easy out in that division. So you'd be foolish not to pick Clemson, I think. But again, much like we were talking about with the SEC East, they take a small step back, which is perfectly reasonable thing to happen. There's a lot of competition there. The Coastal is different to me because I don't think there's as much competition. I think there's three teams at the top that have a real chance, and you could put those three in any order, and that's Carolina, Pittsburgh, and Miami. And Miami's got the quarterback. The other two I have questions about, and I don't know. What do you think about Keaton Slovis? Because we've seen 3 years of him, and I have no idea what to expect from him at Pitt.
Yeah, I think the thing about him is not so much is he capable, but how does he adjust to a dramatically different style of offense? I mean, going from Graham Harrell to Frank Cignetti Jr. is, you know, it's a pretty dramatic shift. And so, and then obviously not having Jordan Addison, although I think Pitt will be okay as far as their overall skill on offense. I think it's just his adjustment. And can he be more like the guy that we saw, kind of early in his USC career when he set records there back in 2019 and did some good things in 2020. So, I think it's one of the more interesting, maybe not talked about transfers in the country. And, you know, he has a test right away with West Virginia, which, you know, weirdly has been more of a defensive program under Neil Brown than an offensive program. And so that's a big game for Keaton in that offense to show, hey, we're going to be all right. We're the defending champs. You know, we're going to be a team that it's going to matter and contend on this side of the ACC and maybe get back to that championship game. But I agree with you. It's the Atlantic has more. Well, if this happens, I mean, I'm just looking at Louisville's schedule after talking them up a little bit. Not easy at all. I mean, starting off at Syracuse, like you mentioned, that new offensive staff with an eye leading the way. Then they're still on the road. They go to UCF less than a week later. Not easy. And then they come back to face what we both think will be an improved Florida State team. And they also have road games against BC, Virginia, Clemson, and Kentucky. So that's a really tough schedule for Scott Satterfield and what should be a key year. Our colleague Pete Thamel mentioned Satterfield in his coaching hot seat piece earlier this week. And while I think he's one of those coaches that if they have a great year, he could be extended and be the guy in the future for the future. Whereas if they fall short, there's going to be some heat on Louisville to make a change. So they're one of the more interesting teams in the country. All right, Hale, you have to give me credit. I've gone this long without bringing up the Big Ten West. You know how much I love the Big Ten West. I live in Big Ten West country, technically. And this is the division that also fits this breakdown because, you know, from year to year, even though it's mostly been Wisconsin or Iowa, this is an up for grabs division. And I think this year certainly qualifies. I personally think, and I'm curious your thoughts, there's four teams that can win the Big Ten West. There's the defending champion, Iowa, which should be really good on defense and can run the ball and do the things that Iowa does. Punting is winning, as the punters NIL campaign goes. Torrey Taylor, who's awesome there. But they're not very good at quarterback. Wisconsin, great on defense. Braylon Allen's terrific. I just wrote about him for ESPN Plus. Hasn't been very good at quarterback, and they need more from Graham Mertz. Minnesota, I think, is one of these teams that could be sneaky good this year because they have been excellent on defense the last few years. They return one of the deeper running back groups in the country. Mo Ibrahim is back from that ruptured Achilles that he suffered after a great performance against Ohio State in the opener last year. Kirk Chiraka returns as their offensive play caller to work with Tanner Morgan, who's been there for like 100 years as the quarterback. And then the best quarterback in the division is at Purdue and Aiden O'Connell, who set all sorts of records last year from completion percentage. He's really, really good, but they lose some on defense. Their coordinator left for Wake Forest. Their top receiver went to the draft. I think their top two receivers are actually gone from last year's team. So we didn't bring up Nebraska, Northwestern, or Illinois, but I think those top four, you can make somewhat of an argument and a strong argument in some case for them to win the division.
this Nebraska erasure will not stand, Adam Rittenberg. I cannot believe just because they go 3-9, you are suddenly writing off Nebraska's hopes. They were in every game last year, darn it. No, I'm with you. This is always a fun division because we talk about like the 50 playoff level teams that are in the other division, and then this one always gets overlooked, and then somehow Iowa wins 7 straight 14-3 games, and they're in the championship game. I am sort of with you on Purdue. Like, that's the team I want to go with here. But I watched a good bit of Purdue last year. David Bell was such a difference maker. Like, I know, like, he wasn't like the sort of star receiver that the NFL looks for with size and speed and all of that. That guy just found a way to get open every single play. And I think Aiden O'Connell's really good too. But he's one of those guys that was just so good that I wonder how much losing him forces a quarterback to take a step back a little bit. But it's, as you said, I mean, this is good or bad. The quarterbacks in this division have experience. I mean, we've seen Aiden O'Connell have a great year. Graham Mertz has been around for forever. He came in with this huge recruiting pedigree. He's never quite lived up to it except for the first game that he played. Again, Tanner Morgan's been around forever. Spencer Petras, I don't even know if he's going to be the guy this year at Iowa. That's a good question, but he's got playing experience. I don't know. I'm all over the map on this. Purdue's the team that I feel like deep down in my heart I want to pick, but I don't really feel good about it. I think if you follow sort of the numbers and the math, and your Braylon Allen piece was great and he was just phenomenal last year, I think I have to go with Wisconsin as like the smart, like pragmatic pick. But my emotional pick is Purdue.
Yeah, I mean, it would be fun to see Purdue make a run. I mean, they ended the season playing really well. They beat Michigan State, and, you know, gave them their first loss, and then they were able to outlast Tennessee in that wild Music City Bowl. So what's exciting about Purdue is we're going to get a pretty good gauge on them right away. They play Penn State on the Thursday night opener, a game that I'll be at, and I'm really excited to see, you know, Manny Diaz, former ACC head coach, is back on the sideline as Penn State's defensive coordinator, trying to flummox, I should say.
I like it better the first way. Let's go.
That's a good word. I think we both worked that into our writing. You probably way better than me. But we're going to get a sense on Purdue. Minnesota is the one. This may be their chance. I mean, they haven't won a league title since 1967. They shared the Big Ten title with Indiana that year. I don't know what the heck happened in the Big Ten in 1967. But Minnesota has been, you know, on a pretty good path under PJ Fleck, and maybe they can finally get it done. So fun Big Ten West conversation as we wrap up.
I struggle with Minnesota, by the way. Just you win 9 games, but you lose to Bowling Green. I can't put those two facts together into one coherent understanding of the Minnesota Gophers.
Also lost to Illinois.
Maybe that's what it is to be a Minnesota fan, though, is to know you can win 9 games, but you're going to lose to Bowling Green.
Just that game was unreal. Just as it was unfolding, it's like, are they really, is this actually going to happen? And then it happened. And certainly that's something that they're going to look to eliminate this year. Well, as we wrap up the pod, we are actually wrapping up our off-season ABCs of college football series, which has been a lot of fun to go through here. Our final letter is actually not Z; it's W. So we kind of got into that point where,
what a cop out.
Yeah, we don't have any Z teams or any. I guess no Y teams. No Yale football breakdown. Maybe we should do that next week, Hale.
We could have spent a whole episode on
Youngstown
Zips.
State. Yeah, we could do the Zips. We could just do it reverse and do nicknames. But I'll go through the W teams, and we've already talked about a few of them in the FBS. Wake Forest went through them, obviously, with the Sam Hartman news. Washington, Washington State, West Virginia, Western Kentucky, Western Michigan, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. So of those teams, let's take Wake Forest out of it. I know we both just talked about Wisconsin a little bit as well. Who interests you, whether it's the Washington schools, you know, Western Kentucky, which had the nation's top passing offense last year with Zapp and Zach Kittley, who's now off to Texas Tech. W schools, who's jumping out to you?
Yeah, Western Kentucky is the first one that sort of jumped out to me because they essentially rented this offense for a year, and it was amazing and fun and great games every week. I will be interested to see what the part two of that is. It's like you know, we decided to do a sequel. We couldn't get any of the stars to come back. So we went out and got like the next level down movie stars, like Ian Ziering is going to be in this for some reason. I think they're going to be fascinating though. Washington certainly is worth discussing because this is a team that on paper recruiting wise should be competing for the Pac-12 every year, should be in the playoff mix, and has just been really bad, particularly last year, and everything that happened there was just a complete train wreck. Was that a blip, or can they get back to where they kind of see themselves? But West Virginia is probably the one that fascinates me the most in this conversation, because you sort of alluded to stylistically how much West Virginia has shifted under Neil Brown. It's been a team that is in a lot of games but hasn't won a lot of games. And then you have what I would argue the most underrated rivalry in college football that hasn't been played for a decade, to start the season off in the backyard brawl with Pittsburgh to open the season, which I am immensely excited for. But boy, if they lose that game, and particularly if they lose that game in any sort of embarrassing fashion, the heat gets turned up on Neil Brown a whole lot. And I think you have to start to ask, like, what's the future of West Virginia? I think they are a really fascinating team that, speaking of realignment, I mean, they already shifted from the Big East to the Big 12 with mediocre results, I would say. And they were, I mean, all but sort of sending out do you like me, yes or no letters to the ACC last year. This is just a team that has such a rich history in college football that is in a little bit of a no man's land right now.
And JT Daniels coming in as the potential quarterback savior, a guy who started at USC under Graham Harrell, went to Georgia, and now is back with Graham Harrell as his play caller as Neil Brown tries to get the old air raid Texas Tech thing fired up there in Morgantown. So just the fact that it's JT Daniels against Keaton Slovis, two quarterbacks that were at USC together under Graham Harrell, and they're going to be playing each other in this resumption of the backyard brawl is just amazing. So I agree, they're interesting. You said a lot of really interesting things, Hale. I just could not stop thinking about Ian Ziering, who is a left-hander, throwing passes to Brian Austin Green on the beach in 1995. So, you know, if Western Kentucky can go after
make
them,
it happen, make that Tyson Helton, like, come let's on, do it.
Let's do it. I mean, that, like, we would be all over the Hilltoppers if they were able to make that happen. So one thing I will add, though, I think the Washington schools are both interesting. New coaches, in a sense, even though Jake Dickert was the acting head coach for the second half of last season, you know, they have an interesting quarterback. And Cam Ward coming in from Incarnate Word, they also brought in his play caller, Eric Morris, trying to channel some of that Western Kentucky magic. And then Kalen DeBoer, a guy that I've been really high on. A lot of people don't know him nationally, but I think his offensive background is going to help a Washington team that was about as ugly to watch offensively the last couple of years as you could imagine, but has had some really good players on the defensive side. So Washington could be interesting this year as the DeBoer era begins in Seattle. That does it for our alphabet. We will have a final off-season-ish podcast for you next week before we really get into the actual season and the podcast coming your way. But wanted to thank David Hale, obviously producer Taylor, and you, of course, for listening and downloading this. This has been the ESPN College Football Podcast.